Is the entertainment industry dying? Well, outside of some notable hits here and there, it certainly seems to be in a steep contraction. Hollywood executives are being laid off, production is petering out. Meanwhile, live theaters are forming coalitions and demanding government aid just to survive, and my spies on the inside claim things are not amazing. In an era where everything from video games to podcasters vie for our attention, where we have infinite entertainment options, just how relevant is show business these days? And what is its future? How can it pull itself out of the lurch? And is that even possible at this point? Well, my guest today certainly has unique insight into these questions and more. Chris Gore is the founder and publisher of FilmThreat.com and host of the Film Threat Livecast on YouTube, the author of several books, most notably The Ultimate Film Festival Survival Guide. Chris is also a filmmaker, having written and produced My Big Fat Independent Movie and directed Attack of the Doc. Chris has hosted shows on FX, Stars, IFC, and appeared as a regular on G4 TV's Attack of the Show. He's also a serial entrepreneur, a bundle of energy and light and insight, and I know you'll enjoy our conversation as much as I did. But first, however you're consuming this podcast, be it Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you prefer to scratch your CDP itch, make sure to leave a like, a comment, or a review if you're nasty. If you're watching on YouTube, I would deeply appreciate you if you subscribed. And as always, you can help this podcast and this community grow by sharing this show as much as possible. If you love it, share it with your friends. And if you hate it, why, as always, share it with your enemies. You can also find me, my verified account on Rumble, where I have exclusive content you literally cannot find anywhere else. So be sure to sign up there and support me on Locals while you're at it. The links will be in the show notes. A little bonus here. I just uploaded an update to my Soul project, my Becoming Tom Soul campaign. So you can sign up there or on my Substack and become a paid subscriber if you want exclusive access to my thoughts on the creative process for that show. Lastly, if you'd like to support me and really make my day, you can buy me a bag of Skittles via PayPal, Venmo, Cash App, or buy me a coffee. All the links will be in the show notes. Stay tuned. My conversation with Chris Gore starts right after these important messages. Part of my job as an artist is understanding the world around me, but with all the bias and noise, it's tough to make sense of anything. Enter Ground News. For pennies a month, this amazing aggregator brings you the hottest current events from outlets all over the world, left, right, and center, and emails you every day to shine light on your blind spots, stories you might have missed due to your own biases. You can install their web extension to learn which way a news site leans and download the Ground News app to get your news on the go. I love this service, friends, and I'm happy to provide loyal listeners of the Clifton Duncan podcast 15% off of an already unbeatable price. Head on over to check.ground.news/Clifton Duncan. Again, head to check.ground.news/Clifton Duncan to get 15% off of Ground News. Get yourself a bird's eye view on world events. Twin Engine Coffee is grown in the gorgeous sunny mountains of Nicaragua, where it's selected, roasted, and packaged before being shipped right to your door. Not only is their bold and aromatic coffee delicious, Twin Engine also employs farmers, tasters, printers, retailers, packers, suppliers, and artists in the local community. Did you know that 99% of the world's coffees are grown in the world's poorest countries? Well, by purchasing Twin Engine Coffee, you are not only treating yourself to the best cup of joe around, you are helping these wonderful people to lift themselves out of poverty. Support small business, support the Clifton Duncan podcast, and support the good people of Nicaragua by ordering from twinenginecoffee.com/CliftonDuncan. Again, that is Twin Engine Coffee at twinenginecoffee.com/CliftonDuncan. Chris Gore, how are you feeling on this fine, fine day?
I'm excited. I think things are bright for the future. And I'm also excited because I'm talking to you. I watch your show. I love you. Have an incredible voice. And I'm just looking forward to all your future efforts, including your upcoming show.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Gore. You know, it cost quite a lot of money to learn how to speak like this. So I'm glad it's being noticed. So the first place I want to start with you, jumping right in. I have my spies in New York, and they tell me, they're actors, they're musicians, they're administrators, and they tell me that they're kind of resigned. They see that everything's being mismanaged, and they're sort of resigned to this idea that there's just not going to be as many jobs going forward as there were before 2020. And then the other day, a video came out of a bunch of Hollywood professionals who, you know, hairdressers and grips and crew members and everything, talking about, hey guys, we're not doing okay. There's less work than ever. What is going on? Everyone is struggling to find jobs and selling their houses because they can't afford to live there. And then you have Deadline, who is doing the series about the contraction in Hollywood, where even executives are now being laid off. So I know you're sort of connected in many ways. So let me just ask you straight up, what is your sense of the morale of Hollywood and the entertainment industry as a whole right now?
Morale is low for several reasons. One, the strikes gained almost nothing. In fact, cost a lot of people their jobs. The industry is contracting because it grew too quickly. I attribute that mainly to streaming and big tech, right? Big tech likes to come in and they say, nice industry you've got there. Nice taxi industry you've got there. How about we add a layer of convenience and we're going to take about a third of your industry. They've done that with hotels, Airbnb. They've done it with a lot of industries. And now they've done it with Hollywood. Look, Apple and Netflix coming in. What Netflix did is in order to gain prominence and position is they overpaid for talent. And that's how they, and then all the other studios thought, well, Netflix has a streaming service. We should start our own streaming service. We went from like a couple of hundred TV shows that were being made, you know, maybe 15, 20 years ago to about 2000 shows where it's like, have you ever had someone say, hey, have you seen the seventh season of this show? I didn't even know that was a show. So you divvied up the pie into thinner and thinner slices. You know, people's pay has not increased. And then you have a wave of new people coming into the industry that has complicated things. I've had friends who tell me that, you know, an HR department at a movie studio would get maybe one or two things they have to deal with personnel wise on a weekly basis. Now it's about 10 or more a day from kids. If you've been on a film set, you've worked with people around entertainment, things can get blue. People are very honest. Sometimes you have to have discussions about that shirt does not look very complimentary on you, except probably said in a worse way. So you've got new people coming in the industry that really just frankly don't know how to hang 18 hours on a film set or a TV set. And then you've got basically the industry shifting views. I think my friend Robert Meyer Burnett said it best. The art form of the 20th century was cinema. The art form of the 21st century is video games. So fewer people are going to the movies. Fewer people are consuming this. And people that are younger, they look to video games and the internet, TikTok, Instagram, you name it, for entertainment. Going to the movies, going to see theater, going to these things are, I don't think they're going away. Cinema's not going away, but the audience has diminished. And don't think that this can't happen. Sorry for this long diatribe at the beginning. I didn't expect you to launch in with such a compelling opening question, but you know, drive-in movie theaters were huge in the 60s, right? They're about 6,000 drive-in theater screens at their height, early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. Now there are about 300. It's just a habit that was broken. And I feel, unfortunately, habits are being broken. And what we're seeing most shift is what I called shared experiences. Movie palaces, movie theaters, theater, roller rinks. Like, name a shared experience. Those are diminishing as habits change. And also, younger people don't have as much disposable income as they used to. So a lot of shifts happening. I think that the desire to be entertained is not going to go away. But I think I see it as a huge opportunity. It's just that where people seek it is different now. But as for traditional Hollywood, it's like one executive said, and you can read this in articles, it's like we're living in post-industry.
Wow.
You know, the industry's over, it's different. And that could be good or bad.
Well, you know, it's interesting that the phrase, the industry is over. Now, for years, I've thought, and I haven't said it out loud, but I genuinely believe that the entertainment industry is no longer people's primary source of entertainment. And back in the day, I mean, you mentioned old habits. You know, when you wanted to see a piece of theater or a piece of drama, television, film, you had to commit to the activity. You had to own a television set and or a VCR. You know, people, maybe the Zoomers don't know quite what that is. You had to get in the car. You had to go to the movies. You had to go to the playhouse. You know, there were just certain things you had to do. And that created, I think, those shared experiences, because there were so there that was before streaming. There were so few outlets and there were so few options that I think we had more of a sort of a cohesive culture and society. But now there's so, you know, I look at it now that Hollywood and the entertainment industry in general now, they've become just another tab on the browser, on your browser. You know, they're in an app now. And I don't know, it seems like maybe now, do you get the sense it's maybe catching up to them, that they're beginning to feel how, I hate to use this term, but how irrelevant they seem to be becoming?
Well, there's a couple things to that. One, you're 100% right. They're becoming less and less relevant because a lot of the messaging doesn't resonate, because they've decided to land on one side of the political aisle rather than, when it comes to shared experiences, things we can all agree on as sort of a central morality that we all agree on. And I don't see that in movies. So Hollywood has lost the zeitgeist. The biggest indicator of that for me is Hollywood used to champion blue collar heroes. Clint Eastwood made two movies where his co-star was an orangutan. He was a truck driver, right? Like, Sally Field with Norma Rae. She worked at a factory. Hollywood now despises blue collar workers.
Yeah.
To their detriment, you know, that was the broad mainstream audience. In fact, they go out of their way, in particular on social media. So, and I'm shocked whenever I see it, but just become less and less surprised. There's like a disdain for people who just maybe think a little differently. And we've lost that sort of central values that we could all agree upon that are very simple. Heroes, heroes have been taken away. It's disheartening. If anything, if Hollywood or anyone somehow tapped into the zeitgeist of what people are really feeling right now, there's a movie. It's going to sound like a weird nerd reference, but you've been on FNT many times. You'll get it. There was a warning in the 1930s about the rise of fascism, and it was through a comic strip that became a serial at the movies, and it was called Flash Gordon. And Flash Gordon was about this totalitarian leader named Ming the Merciless, and he took the kingdoms of Mongo and he made them fight amongst each other, right? As a way to distract from the fact that he was the real evil in control. And there's so much division in this country now, it just saddens me, whether it's gender, race, whatever, it's, or even like sexuality now, there's so much division. It sort of sickens me to not recognize that there's a class divide that's being pushed. It's so obvious to anyone that can just take a step back and go, oh yeah, they're just making us fight amongst each other, so we don't notice the fact that, you know, I barely any politicians even give lip service to the term the American dream. Where's the lip service they used to give to that? I, you know, almost look fondly back at like political speeches that would put shivers down my spine. I would get excited about this country and about how beautiful it is that anyone can choose a pathway towards success, however you measure it, choose that pathway. And that's becoming less and less possible, in particular for younger people being fed so much propaganda. Hey, this was going to be fun, right? We were going to talk about entertainment and theater. I have to say, I so admire so much of what you've done and how you've transformed yourself. And just as someone who's, I mentioned earlier, the shared experiences, you know, more than I, the energy in the room, whether you're seeing a film or during a stage play. I was a season ticket holder for years for the Pantages Theater in Hollywood. I've seen Wicked 5 times. I've seen like so many great stage plays there. I mean, a lot of them Broadway productions that come to Hollywood, and you can't capture that energy. You can't capture that energy in any other circumstance. It's you're in the room, something's happening live. You feel so much. I miss that's not being passed on to a new generation. And a lot of these experiences now are solitary.
Well, I think on top of that, firstly, thank you for the kind words. You said a lot there.
Sorry.
No, it's good. Well, you know, by the way, I always have to remind people, you know, no one is here to hear what I have to say. They want to hear what you have to say. I want to hear what you have to say. So please don't apologize for yourself. But this idea of people having more solitary experiences, this idea that we're more atomized than ever, I think that's sort of where I become concerned as well, because I've said often that art is one of the most unifying forces that we have in society. And it's one of the few places, I mean, we're not going to find accord over politics or over religion, but, you know, whether it's you're at the opera or you're at a dance show, a hip hop concert or whatever, you can come from wherever you come from and then go into a room with a bunch of strangers and have an experience and maybe even be changed in some way. And I think part of the issue right now, I mean, you mentioned sort of this, I felt this sort of cultural malaise. People seem sort of hopeless. I think part of the problem is that we have so many quote unquote artists who are activists who are masquerading as artists, and they're so cynical. I mean, I've talked about this on my show before. There is no, there's very little capacity for the aspirational, for the transcendent, for the awe-inspiring, for the sense of wonder, because we have to kind of comment on everything. We have to be kind of removed from everything. Everything is unjust or unequal. Everything is problematic in some way. So we can't allow ourselves just be open, open individuals who can enjoy a piece of work and be vulnerable and be reminded of our own humanity through that vulnerability. Last thing I want to say is this idea, and I noticed this, I first noticed this when I was actually in conservatory at NYU, and there was a huge divide between myself and my 17 classmates, not all of them, but I found that, I had difficulty relating to a lot of my classmates because they came from a more privileged background. And I became kind of sensitive to that at that time, but then 2015 came around. And the election came around, and that's when I just said, holy crap, these people, they absolutely despise the regular sort of blue collar, salt of the earth individual. And it just really disgusted me because I grew up, I was an army brat. I've lived overseas. I've traveled all over America and worked as an actor. And you're talking about dismissing just good, solid, everyday people who work hard and who need some kind of respite from their lives. And that's sort of where entertainment comes in, where art can come in. And I wonder what you think about this, because my sense is that part of the issue, and it wasn't always this way, is that if you wanted to be in this industry before, you know, you were like an apprentice, or you showed up and interned somewhere. If you wanted to learn how to act or sing, you took private lessons or went to a private school and lived your life normally. But now we have this system where university becomes a gateway and a pipeline into the industry, whether you're doing theater or TV and film. And now all those weird theater kids that in your high school are going to, they're going off to college and they're becoming, you know, writers, actors, directors, and so on and so forth. So I think part of the issue now is that this culture of academia, this, I call it the bourgeoisie, this one bourgeois method of looking at the world is now, it now is the identity of the cultural identity of the industry. And year after year after year, you have a bunch of new BFAs and MFAs freshly minted who are coming into the industry with these same, you know, who've been in school for 16 or 19 years, who have this one worldview, and they think this is what it is, and that's what the industry is now. And I think that's part of the issue as well. It's just it's people going to from college, where they learned a bunch of bad ideas, into the industry, where they get a chance to share those bad ideas with the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's unfortunate to see. It's changed a lot since I was in college. I'm frankly I'm a college dropout, and
One
of the things I had observed was I vividly remember getting out of high school and thinking, wow, I know a lot of stuff, but I don't know how to do my taxes. I don't know how to do like things that I thought were practical. And I even went out of my way when I was in high school in the 80s, because I'm the ancient one at this point. But I took a lot of extracurricular classes because I wanted to learn basics, like just how to type a typing class, right? Like simple things. But I remember getting out of high school thinking, I really don't know a lot of stuff. And what I felt was what formal education does is teach a lot of how to be a good worker bee. And I didn't want that. I ended up going on this trip to California where my uncle moved and visited him. And I wanted to go to USC because that was the school that George Lucas went to. No way was I going to be able to afford the tuition there. But I asked my mother, I said, well, take me to the campus of USC. So I went to the bookstore and I bought every book I could that was part of the film program at the time. Because I thought, well, if I can't afford to go to the school, I will read every single book that all the kids, the rich kids that went to the school, I'll read all those books. I couldn't afford to buy them all, but I made a list of the names of the books and the authors. Dropped out of school after 2 years where I went to Wayne State University, and I read all those books because I just wanted to toe-in-toe at least have that self, you know, be self-taught in that way. Fun fact, two fun facts. One, Quentin Tarantino dropped out of school in the eighth grade, which is why he's still a terrible speller. Brilliantly creative person, brilliant writer, not very good at spelling. Who cares? But, you know, I then went on to write a book. I kind of figured out a good way to write a book. Like, oh, this is just writing a book's not that hard. Nobody sets out to write a book. What you do is you write 500 words a day, maybe 1,000 words a day. On a good day, if I'm on a roll, 3,000 words a day. Do that for 2 months. You've got between 50 and 60,000 words, which is the length of a book. I wrote four editions of a book called The Ultimate Film Festival Survival Guide, which became required reading as part of independent film studies at USC, UCLA, AFI. And I'm really fond of like, whenever I've gone to do like public speaking engagements, I'll tell that story that like, look, I'm a dropout. You're reading my book. You're paying to read my book. Probably just could have bought the book, but whatever, it's fine. I think the thing is there's not an awareness that there are multiple pathways towards success. And when you look at anybody who's been successful in film or in entertainment, they have very non-traditional ways. The going to film school and then becoming a filmmaker is rare, technically speaking. A lot of people self-taught, like I mentioned, Tarantino, you know, people like Todd Phillips though. I mean, he just went and made a movie right out of film school. He went to NYU film school. He started the New York Underground Film Festival. Then he made a movie called Hated, G.G. Allen and the Murder Junkies. My company Film Threat in the 90s, we distributed his first film on VHS back in the day. But I really think that the life of an independent artist, which is not an easy life, just let me say, I've sort of had one foot in, I'll work for the corporate masters, if they're willing to pay me and can work around what my demands are. But I've always done something independent on the side. Always. Never not. Never not. Since I was 19 years old, I've always done an independent project, whether it's a film, Film Threat magazine, which I created, books that I've done, always done a side project and then a corporate job and whatnot. And then you begin to learn that, like, no matter how much money I have, I'm always like, well, it might not work for 6 months. So you kind of learn to live inexpensively, or where I have always just lived below my means because I don't want to worry about money, right? When there's those dry patches that come along, which are normal, but entrepreneurship, I think, is not taught. There are plenty of books about really great books about entrepreneurship. One of the ones I really like is The 4-Hour Work Week. There's a lot of really good books about just becoming an entrepreneur. I really think it's about assembling your team, right? You bring your team together, Film Threat as a team. Whenever I start another project, like a movie, an independent movie, I have a separate team. And because the thing I've always resented about the corporate world or corporate creativity, which I think corporations just kill creativity, is that they assign a value to you. Whereas you can choose a value that you think you're worth and work toward that. Whereas a corporation will say, that pays this, and it pays this for X amount of time. But all my friends who have been working actors, friend of mine, Tommy Bechtel, he's a comedian. I did improv with him back in the day. He was like a recurring guy on like Jimmy Kimmel, but then he's been on some HBO Max shows. And he learned that early on, like, he'll get paid a lot of money, but he doesn't act like he has money, right? It's always kind of just, you got to learn that, right? If you want to stay working in entertainment. But what I've always done is just like identify a project I want to do, what it's going to cost, and just think real world and common sense about it, and then just go from there.
Definitely great.
I know that's like probably like, it sounds like it's like, and it's so easy. It never is. But struggle is a good thing. I think struggle builds character. I always say, like, have a Mick job, which is a job you dislike, that you really don't like, that will work toward the thing that you want to do. So it's important to have a Mick job to build character. I worked when I lived in Michigan, in Detroit, I worked at factories. I was like one of those where they just send you off on, you don't know what job you're going to have, and you just do that job. I worked fast food, worked at Burger King, worked at a gas station. A couple of those jobs I got fired for. One job I got fired for because I brought a book to read. This is the late shift working at a gas station. I'm going to think there are going to be moments where I can like glance and read a couple chapters of a book. So I was fired for that, but I don't care. And I don't know. It's I've always been very like singular minded where here's the thing I got to get done. And then I just work toward that thing. I think there's sort of OCD that way.
Well, I think there's something to be said about practicality and life skills and being sort of having some scars put on your soul by life before you know, and then you use that in your work. And I think part of the issue, especially with academia and people using that as a gateway into the industry, is that they miss out, and I think in some ways, on dealing with people, dealing with the world, dealing with society. And that I think it leads to this sort of disconnect. You know, you mentioned Quentin Tarantino, and it's a great segue to shift gears for me, because do you think that Quentin Tarantino, as brilliant as he is, would have a shot in the industry today in its current state as a white male?
100% no, he would not.
100%, wow.
100% there would not be, no. I mean, I know the state of the industry, what it is now. He was fortunate to, you know, have, you know, he had his script True Romance, which he sold. And then Reservoir Dogs, he was so frustrated. He said, I will just make it for $10,000 in Super 8. That was his plan. And then Lawrence Bender, his producer, said, please, please give me some time to shop it around. He got Harvey Keitel to step up to be the executive producer. That's not the climate in Hollywood now. There are not going to be even someone like a Christopher Nolan, frankly, who made, you know, maybe a more recent example. He made a movie called Following. He did the smart thing. He didn't go in debt like Kevin Smith or other indie filmmakers. Charge it up on your credit cards. And that, please don't do that. It's very irresponsible. Chris Nolan worked, he worked at like a photo lab and would just had like a normal day job during the day. He could afford one reel of film, 16 millimeter black and white film, and afford processing for that reel, right? About 20 minutes of footage. And he would buy that reel. He would shoot on the weekends his movie. And when the film was done, he was done shooting. Shot on like a 3-to-1 ratio, shot all through the summer and made a movie called Following that ended up being at the Slamdance Film Festival. Remember seeing that film that year. It's the only DVD where Christopher Nolan did DVD commentary. He famously does not do commentary for his movies. The following year, he made a movie called Memento, which then was at the Sundance Film Festival. He was the big discovery. That is not the climate today, unfortunately. You need to be able to check certain boxes to get the attention of mainstream, because that's what they're looking for, right? It's an overcompensation, but I think it's also like people that don't pay attention, like, and I was maybe blind to it because I've been covering independent films since the 80s and 90s, and I would see a lot of movies at Sundance, and I would see like, and we called them underground alternative films. They weren't really called independent films until 1989 when the Sundance Film Festival was previously called the United States Film Festival and changed the name to Sundance, right? And I've seen these just great indie movies, but they're limited audiences, right? They're limited audience films. I'm talking about queer cinema, a lot of just like, where you look at the movie, you're like, oh, wow, I'm really moved by this thing, but I know the audience is very small. The thing is that now a lot of these types of ideas, like the movie Bros, for example, which was made for $50 million, and it's a gay romantic comedy. Fine, great. But it was made for $50 million, thinking it would be mainstream. It's not mainstream. Had that movie been made for less than $5 million, opened in 2 theaters, it would have been a huge hit. Same script. You just got to scale the budget to the audience. And I think the problem is now is that films, you know, that would have been considered, you know, limited release indie movies are now big budget Hollywood movies. I think it's a huge mistake. I think it's a clearly not understanding the mainstream audience for film. And then also, you know, vilifying half the country. You know, I think it's important even as a media outlet for me at Film Threat, filmthreat.com website, we talk about independent film. And I say to everyone, we are politically agnostic. We're not on any other, either side of the aisle. We will cover a drag queen documentary. We will also cover a documentary called The Boys in Red Hats, which is a documentary about the Covington kids who wore MAGA hats and then were smeared by the mainstream media. And Nick Sandman, who was one of the kids, his family was threatened. All sorts of terrible things happened to him. Won a huge lawsuit against CNN for being maligned. But it was just weird when I began to see friends in the industry, and I'll talk to them privately, not on social media. I don't call out people on social media because I've never seen a conversation on social media end well where people disagree. They almost become more polarized in their positions. But I'll privately talk to friends at screenings when I see them. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, why do you said this on Twitter? Like, is that, how do you think that helps things? Do you think you're convincing anybody? You're just further polarizing. And they're perfectly pleasant in person sometimes, though I've come to learn that friends of mine, I say that I'm part of the alt middle, which may as well put me on the far right. But I've always been more libertarian, more of a centrist, more of a like, well, they seem crazy over there. I'm going to vote this side. Well, now this side seems crazy. I'll vote this way. And I try to look at the person and the policies and not the party. Right. So, because I think that's maybe a smarter way to spend my vote. And I've never missed an election When I turned 18, I couldn't wait to vote. Always paid attention. Even when I was a kid, I would watch debates. I think the first one I remember was Carter and Reagan back in the 70s. So yes, I was a weird kid. I'm Gen X. When I was 11, I was 30 years old. And now it's like I'm older and probably act a little younger, I was a very serious minded kid and always goal driven and worked to get money. I didn't realize this is what you get, Clifton. You invited me on your show. Now you're getting me ADD going all over the place. But, I didn't know I was poor. I was like lower middle class, single mother raised me. But because I was loved by my grandparents, my aunts, my mother, who really worked hard, my sister, who I grew up with, I didn't notice it. It wasn't until like getting later in high school that it's like, oh, wow. So I've got like two pairs of pants and like a couple of shirts. And I don't know, I can't afford the ski club because that costs money. It's like, oh. And then I realized like, I just worked for, if I wanted something, I worked for it. So I had newspaper routes, mowed lawns, shoveled sidewalks in the snow, and just learned like, oh, I put effort, I get money, I get what I want. I create my own opportunity. I've always had that philosophy, whether it's any project I'm doing. And while I've worked for companies, I've done television shows for FX, E, G4, probably the one that people know the most. I've sort of kept one foot in there, but always done my own thing. So, which I would recommend that you do. I recommend that have a thing that is yours and yours alone. No one could take that away from you.
That's sort of the part of the problem in the industry now is that so many people are reliant on it. And that's like their whole identity, and they wouldn't be anything if it went away. I want to, we've been talking around it a bit, but it seems unavoidable now. One example I think of is our mutual friend Andre Einherjar. From Midnight's Edge. And I mentioned this to him as well because I love that channel so much. And they stayed away from politics so well, but now it's almost unavoidable. And I see more of their videos now covering these kinds of topics. And I think it's the nature because it's just the nature of the culture and the industry now that it's become so saturated by these things. And so I think what I was getting at with the Tarantino question outside of the structure of the industry as it is now is, I just wonder because you did this incredible, or this, you were sent this incredible article or letter, open letter, from anonymous writer from the Writers Guild, talking about diversity quotas and the sort of representation edicts that have been passed down by the industry. So I'm wondering if someone like a Chris Nolan or a Quentin Tarantino would even be considered today. Would they have the same kind of shot? I mean, I kind of feel like guys like that probably would have found their own way anyway.
Right.
But just given that personality, but it also seems to me, because I also, again, I talk to my friends in New York and actors, musicians, and they're saying something similar in terms of, the work has dried up for us. And we know specifically because it's because we're white. Mm-hmm. And it's not as though these are straight white males. A couple of my friends are gay. One of them is a woman. And they all see it. And they all talk about it. And they know they can't talk about it openly. What's the temperature of feeling like there? Are you hearing the same things over in Hollywood? Has it become? I feel like it's a dumb question, but it's like an open season, open culture of anti-white discrimination going on in Hollywood right now?
Yes, that is the short answer to that question is yes. We've replaced sort of old bad tropes with new bad tropes. And we've overcompensated for an industry that was organically, I've been around the industry for a long time. There have always been gay people in the industry. The industry, was not as diverse as it could have been back in the day, but I feel like that was corrected, certainly recently, but when you look at a movie like Hollywood Shuffle, which came out in 1987, okay, that movie was hilarious because it was true. Because what it pointed out was, if you looked a certain way, you were stereotyped. That is not the case any longer. But it's just, you've replaced one kind of racism with another. I think it's all, you know, it's, I don't know, it's just disgusting to see. But I think that the people that have, you know, really persevered are the ones that always created their own opportunities. Another example, you know, nobody hired Spike Lee to make She's Gotta Have It or School Days or Do the Right Thing. He hired himself. I don't recall him complaining about opportunities in indie film. His complaints about the Oscars were valid. I think that they overcompensated in another direction, but I've always admired him as a filmmaker because he was always, I mean, you can look back at stories from years ago, the mainstream media always came after him. And I've interviewed him several times. I think he's great because he just doesn't care and does what he wants. And certainly the beginnings of his career with She's Gotta Have It created that character, Mars Blackman. I mean, I think he's just learned that independent film is where I'm going to go. I don't want people to tell me what to do, box me in or label me. So he's in a category all by himself. There are other people, you know, Tyler Perry, who built his studio in, you know, Atlanta. He makes movies for a particular market. He scales the budget to fulfill that market. Follow that model, right? You don't need Hollywood, because I feel the problem is, I feel a lot of the stories that Hollywood tells when it's about a particular ethnicity, and, you know, it's almost like they do a stereotypical way. It's still filtered through a lens. Like when Disney wants to have diversity, it feels like the least organic thing you'll ever see. It's terrible. Disney is the worst about it. It's, you know, gays are very stereotypical. Like everyone, it's so like not real. And this just comes from me watching independent films for years where there's an unfiltered voice. If you're making a movie for a corporation, it is filtered. Have no doubt about that. The person with the power is the person with the money, not the person behind in the director's chair or even necessarily the producers always. And one of the things I hear over and over again is being noted to death. And that is why it's no fun to make a movie for Marvel anymore or for Disney. It's so many notes that you get from people who have nothing to do with this industry. And what we've seen is Hollywood has bent over for several grifts. That's where things have changed. I'll recount what they are real quick. COVID was a grift. COVID compliance officer is a real credit on movies. Okay. Money that needs to be allocated from a budget.
I called them COVID cops, by the way.
Oh, I had to pay a fee insurance for an event that I put on. I put on an award show. I started my own award show. I was tired of small independent films not getting recognition. 5 years ago, I said, I'm just going to start my own award show. So I did. We do it every year. Do it. Everything that happens at a real award show we have. But I had to hire 1 year. We couldn't do it. We did it at a drive-in so we could follow the rules. It was an outdoor event. You still had to pay money. So you've got COVID compliance officer, intimacy coordinator. You've got DEI. So you have people from Amazon, I think, has the most dystopian rules. You've got people from the HR department, effectively. It's a wing of the HR department telling you the types of jokes you can write for different types of people. If you're going to, if you're writing for certain types of people, certain jokes cannot be said. It's Amazon has the worst. I'll send you the link. We did a video about that. And I talked to my friends in the Writers Guild because a lot reached out to me and it just said, this is just Orwellian, that people who've never made a movie or are not literate in the language of film or what makes great entertainment are dictating rules of what you can and cannot do in a film or a TV show. This is part of doing any kind of art, as you know. I don't need to tell you any of this, is you got to take a risk. You got to take risks. Risk is part of it. It's failing, maybe crossing some lines, but ultimately delivering an experience to an audience that makes them feel something. The thing I've noticed that I think is most egregious is seeing, one, the desexualization of women in film and TV, the shame of men. There's much more male nudity. The recent John Cena on the Oscars. And frankly, I actually have no problem with what John Cena did. That was very funny. Equal opportunity. We're going to see John Cena naked on stage. Let's see the same joke the other direction. I'm all about it. Let's go. But you've also seen romance is gone in film. One of the first things I noticed about when the Star Wars sequel, the first one, came out, The Force Awakens, was, wow, one of the great things about all the Star Wars films has some romance. Yes, it's cheesy, fairy tale like, and mainly on a very child level, but there was romance.
There was, but even then, just to cut in really quickly Han Solo and Leia, I mean, there was a maturity about that love story. There was grief, right, and loss and suffering, and, you know, he's rough around the edges and she's strong willed, and it was great to see the two of them just bounce off of each other. So yeah. But continue.
Yeah, but she was not a damsel in distress. That's why I think Princess Leia, Carrie Fisher's, that's why she's such a popular character. Not a damsel in distress, takes charge, but also is a woman. And Hollywood has not figured out how to portray romance in modern cinema. And it is, whenever I see it, it stands out. It's like that movie with Sidney Sweeney, Anyone But You. Okay. I'm like, oh my God, this is like a romantic comedy from, could have been made 20 years ago or in the 90s, you know, and it's fine. It was just shocking. Like, wow, you can actually have like people with chemistry that are attracted to each other in a film, but that's now rare. It used to be they would churn out romantic comedies, and it was a way to kind of build people up. You make these movies that are low budget, you know, starring, like, I don't know, Matthew McConaughey is an up and coming star. Just put him in a romantic comedy, pair him with whoever. These movies are cheap to make. It's the same script every time for the most part, someone running to the airport, whatever. You do some twists on it so it seems original, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with those films. They're, you know, they're the potato chips of going to the movies. They're just, you just eat another one. It's fine. Those are rare now. And the fact that comedies right now, if somebody made a movie called Not Another Woke Hollywood Movie, that would be a huge movie. And if it just went for it and didn't care, I don't know that it would be released in many theaters, but that's the kind of thing you need. You know, I look at Blazing Saddles. The thing that stood out to me in Blazing Saddles, I had to sneak into it when I was a kid. Snuck in to see it as a kid. I was too young, R-rated movie. The thing that I loved were the fart jokes, because I'd never seen a movie with a fart joke, which they sanitized and censored on television.
Really?
Forget the N-word for a second. It was the fart joke that was just like, oh my gosh, like, there's farts in a movie? We're all laughing. But that movie is such a great commentary. One of my favorite videos to watch on YouTube are young Black YouTubers watching Blazing Saddles for the first time, how shocked they are. You know, I love it.
Well, you know, it's so ridiculous, because I've said for years now that everything has become sanitized for everyone's protection, and all it's done is destroy. I mean, I haven't really heard anyone else talk about this, but I've been thinking about it myself, about how they focus on sex and sexuality, but there's no love or romance. And, you know, they focus on the here and the now and the physical sensation or whatever your preference might be, but not about building just strong bonds. And I think, you know, I was doing this workshop of this show that was supposed to go to Broadway, but then I got purged. So that's not happening anymore. And we're talking about, the director said to me at one point, he goes, men chasing women is very, very bad. And it's funny, because my female co-star, you know, was complaining about how men had not, you know, had failed her or whatever. And I was like, well, you're just bitter. But, you know, I'm like, well, but I'm like, yeah, you know, we don't want a predator, but men chasing women is sort of why we're all here. And the idea we have these intimacy coordinators, which is insane, you know, or the idea that there's somebody there. I mean, how racist does it sound to or bigoted does it sound to have someone who says these are the kind of jokes you can tell for certain audiences? I mean, can you imagine a Red Fox or Richard Pryor or an Eddie Murphy or Dave Chappelle saying, man, I'm going to tell these kind of jokes for this one kind of audience. And that's going to, or George Carlin, I'm going to tell these one kind of jokes for this one particular. It doesn't make any sense. And it's like these people are so disconnected from what being a person is that they are imposing all these rules. And I swear everyone can feel it. Everyone can feel it. There's something just off about a lot of our cinema, a lot of our drama. And I think it's kind of what we're talking about is that we're imposing all these rules on what the art is. And it's, you know, whether it's not only just it, like, I wish that we could go back to the days where we complained that Hollywood was too corporate and too commercial, because now it's not only corporate and commercial, but now there's all these sort of other ideological strictures being placed on the work. And it's just, and as an actor, as an artist, it's, let me tell you, it's no fun to be around. As you were talking about, you know, you need to be open, you need to be bold, especially as an actor, you need to be able to remove these social masks. I mean, a lot of our learning, my teachers would like, you know, we can't really teach you anything. We just have to sort of help you unlearn all of your social programming, because to be an actor, to be an artist, you're not being a normal person. You're going to emotional places, psychological places that normal people just don't go. And that's where all the magic really is anyway. And now it's like, we have a culture now and an institution, an industry now, which is full of people who have sort of become disconnected from their own humanity for ideological reasons. It's very strange.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just to quote the Critical Drinker, the message, Hollywood has always had kind of, but it was messaging, you could all get behind or agree upon, right? I think that that's the thing that's been lost. Now there are different types of messages being pushed. I notice it right away. It stands out where, you know, you didn't see that. But like, I guess the thing is that there's a whole group of people, a lot of them in development or a lot of them in on the sort of entry-level positions in Hollywood that have no sense of real film or even TV history, right? This is the first time. It's not the first time it's ever happened. It's just that's your narcissism showing. Because I grew up with a whole different kind of TV. One of my favorite TV shows growing up as a kid, you probably never heard of this show. Maybe you did. What's Happening is my favorite show.
Yeah.
I loved Raj because I identified with Raj. This is another bad idea. I want to come back to that. Identify with Raj because Raj was a nerd. He wore glasses. I wore glasses. Being raised by a strong single mother. And there was always a moral dilemma in the show. And I related to that. Like, oh man, it's so tough. Like growing up, like whatever. I'm just this nerdy kid. And I loved What's Happening. It was a show with like good values, like really likable, fun characters. It also wasn't the only show that was like that on TV. There was a lot of that, but those things seem to have been forgotten. There's a terrible idea that's been spread in academia and social media. I see it all the time, which is I need to have someone who looks exactly like me in order to identify with that character. Wrong. The entire purpose of all fiction and storytelling, whether it's a comic book, a novel, a video game, a movie, a stage play, a TV show, whatever, is to learn empathy. That's what it means to be human, is to empathize with the lead character, whether it's not the same gender as you, maybe for me it's a woman, or not the same ethnicity, maybe doesn't speak the same language, maybe isn't human. Maybe it's a pig in a story like Charlotte's Web or something. You know what I mean? Like, this is the whole point of fiction, is to learn to see the world through someone else's eyes who do not look like you. And when you tell a generation of young people, well, you can only identify with someone who looks like you, in a narcissistic way, they want to change everything and put only people who look like them in stories. And that doesn't make any sense. It's never made sense to me. and you lose the opportunity of seeing the world through someone else's eyes. That's the point, I think, of so much storytelling, is to make us see things we wouldn't normally see.
Well, there's also this element now that it didn't, you know, and it's a generational thing. I know you see it and feel it too, but, you know, I see all these Zoomers, these young, quote unquote, progressives who try, you know, I feel torn because the idea of representation, I understand it, but I also think it's kind of racist in a bit, in a way, because you're saying that one of us can stand in for all of us. And I grew up watching, you know, you mentioned What's Happening, but I grew up watching shows like Amen, 227, Cosby Show, Family uh-huh. Matters, Living Single, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Martin. And each of these shows, The Jeffersons, Good Times, each of these shows showed a different aspect of Black Americans from completely different aspects of life and different social classes and all this other stuff. So, you know, the idea that, you know, if I'm talking about, you know, am I going to be represented in, I mean, does Will Smith represent me or does Carlton represent me? Right, or does, right. or, you know, does Uncle Phil or the butler, or mm-hmm. is it Kyle from Living Single, or I forgot the guy's name, but the plumber, you know, from that same show, you know, what about Carl Winslow from Family Matters? Does he represent me, or Rock, you know, Charles Dutton, who plays this garbage man, you know? So it's weird because now, I mean, you mentioned before, people are so obsessed with being first about everything. And I'm, you know, like Black Panther comes out, like, this is for us. I'm like, dude, Wesley Snipes was like one of the biggest action stars in the 90s. You know what I mean? Like, and he did Blade, for God's sake. Like, mm-hmm. that dude was, I mean, extraordinary actor, but also a great mover. So, I mean, he, and a comedic, like, he could do everything. He's amazing. But in service of this idea that we're making all these firsts and making history, people like him get forgotten. And it's so irritating. Just these other shows as well. It's the sitcoms I mentioned. These shows get forgotten. And that we have to pretend they never existed because we have to make progress. Well, I mean, what are we progressing toward, and what are we moving toward, and what are we improving upon? The last thing that I want to get into, you mentioned very briefly at the beginning, you talked about the strikes, and that was a story that I sort of refused to follow just because of my own personal feelings. I think you know a bit why that is, but I noticed one just a pervasive apathy. Like, no one seemed to care that Hollywood shut down for months. So I guess my question for you is, I mean, what has the fallout been from the strikes? You mentioned that they weren't very productive. I want to hear your thoughts on that, but also the advent of AI and what that means for the future of the industry. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Ooh, that's two really big questions.
Go for it. One is yours.
Yeah. One, the industry now will shrink by not just a third, perhaps half, in terms of the numbers of television shows and productions being made. So it's just like the situation with the Titanic. There are only so many boats, only so many people are going to survive in this industry. I have a friend who's a producer who has been out of work so long, just decided, I'm going to culinary school. You're always going to need a cook. That's what I'm going to do. This is how bad the situation has gotten. So really, we're shooting themselves in the foot. I don't know. I think that AI, I'm not as bleak when in terms of predictions for how AI is going to change the industry. I believe that AI will be used a lot in special effects, in animation. You'll probably see it in children's animation first. I think it'll be used as a tool for writers, but it's kind of like, I use Photoshop. I am not an artist. And my use of Photoshop is I can make a flyer, you know, for a convention appearance, but I can't do what a lot of friends of mine that are very good with Photoshop can do. AI is a tool, just like Photoshop. In the hands of an artist, a great tool. In the hands of someone like me that is not particularly tech savvy, probably not going to work for me. And a lot of, there's a sameness to a lot of how the AI stuff looks. I think it's going to help from a budgetary standpoint, but I still believe you need someone who understands art, who understands technique, who understands storytelling. It's not AI in the hands of some. You're going to be able to make some great little AI images of yourself in a narcissistic way. We've seen people experiment with AI, but I do believe that it's going to be a tool that still has to be in the hands of an artist behind the mouse, computer, the stylus, whatever you think. Someone else has to be there guiding it and whatnot. And also, computers are stupid. They all, just like to quote Seth Brundle from David Cronenberg's The Fly, computers are stupid. They only know what you tell them. So they can only copy a style and jumble it. It's sort of like when you play a video game and you have the randomizer when you create a character. I see AI as not artificial intelligence, it's simulated intelligence, to quote my friend Script Doctor. It's a randomizer, so you can take like right Back to the Future 4. Well, AI, quote AI, is going to take the scripts for the first three Back to the Future and just create sort of a facsimile of it, like a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. It will be a game changer in terms of budgets. I think it's going to impact indie film in a positive way, in the sense that indie film will be able to, in a very short amount of time, be able to compete with Hollywood. You may see a George Lucas of the future, a Quentin Tarantino of the future, using AI tools on a low budget level to spend a couple million bucks to make it look like a movie that was made for $100 million. I'm seeing it right now. A friend of mine, you can look him up on YouTube. His name is Damon Packard, D-A-M-O-N, Packard, has been doing experiments with AI. People are writing articles about him. He's not even aware of it. He's doing these experiments with AI. It's weird, but he's making these short films using AI. He did a fake behind the scenes making of the 1984 David Lynch Dune that is just hilarious. And he's just playing with tools. So I'm hopeful for the future. I think the future is entrepreneurship as an artist. And it's the weirdest thing, because my book, The Ultimate Film Festival Survival Guide, and a lot of the writing that I do about film, and a lot of my commentary is, you know, you need about like 5-10% passion. Go for your dream. That's great. But you also need the other side of your brain, which unfortunately a lot of artists are not wired for. Or you need someone that's a part of your team to be wired for business. You need that. You need that. And you need to, unfortunately, I mean, it's the most expensive art form, filmmaking. And it also requires, you know, really, if you look at it, the most successful in film aren't the best filmmakers. It's the best business people who are filmmakers. I would put someone like Steven Spielberg in that group. Probably arguably the most successful filmmaker revenue-wise. Very amazing artist and very business savvy. George Lucas, you know, was an independent filmmaker, right? Who got funding from 20th Century Fox. So when you look at the most successful filmmakers of all time, they're usually people who are wildly creative artists who have found a way to write their own rules when it comes to business. I mean, if Quentin Tarantino wanted to be more commercial with his movies, certainly his movies would have grossed or made more money. I don't think he cares. I think he's very comfortable making the types of movies that he does. And he's built, I'm really looking forward to his final film. We'll see if that's really the case, called The Film Critic, tentatively titled The Film Critic. So I'm optimistic about the future. As Hollywood dies, it's only going to be replaced by something else. And if you look at film history, there have been other moments where Hollywood died. And the main reason was in the 70s, while in the late 60s, early 70s, when there was so much social upheaval, when there was so much happening politically in the world, Hollywood was making these big budget musicals that bombed. Hollywood was so out of touch with the zeitgeist and what was happening politically in the 60s and 70s that they just were on the verge of collapse. That's why you had the rise of these young Turks at the time, Spielberg, Lucas, Coppola, among others, that actually kind of tapped into that zeitgeist. So be entrepreneurial, tap into the zeitgeist, and look at look at what's happening in Hollywood now, because I don't really see it changing. I think that Hollywood is going to stick by those rules, but I'm optimistic. So,
yeah, I mean, I also feel that the pendulum is not going to swing back in terms of the industry, but I am encouraged because I feel like the sort of collective, if you will, creativity of a bunch of people who are not in that system is going to be far and who have great tools and knowledge at their disposal are going to be better than this sort of, you know, this hive mind that exists in LA and New York right now. And the last thing I would say is that I love that you mentioned the 70s, because as soon as you mentioned that's the era that I thought about. And I thought about a book specifically. Have you ever read Pictures at a Revolution?
I have not, actually.
Oh, dude, you have to read it, because exactly what you said. So for those who don't know, Pictures at a Revolution, I forgot the author. I want to say Mark Freeman. He's the husband of the playwright Tony Kushner, as a matter of fact. But it's a brilliant book, which is set, not set, but it's it examines the Best Picture Oscar race in 1968, 1969. And it looks at the five films that were involved in that and how those five films sort of were, it was like old Hollywood and new Hollywood, because one of the films that was up was Dr. Dolittle, a musical. People were like, why the hell is this movie here? So it's a great film about, it goes into detail about the, you know, the players behind the scenes, how the films came into being. I mean, you read about Dustin Hoffman's audition for The Graduate, as a matter of fact. I think the films were, it was two Poitier films. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was one, like, right, just like old Hollywood, right? But then the other was In the Heat of the Night, which I think holds up way better than the first film does. Then there was Warren Beatty's Bonnie and Clyde. There was The Graduate, and there was Dr. Dolittle, like I said. Yeah. And so it's such a fascinating thing to think about, how these sort of young rebellious filmmakers who actually caught, not necessarily young, you know, but the filmmakers who caught the zeitgeist of the time, who said, you know what, we're actually going to look at the social upheaval of these times and reflect what that is. Those films resonated so much more now. And I think they hold up better as well than a Dr. Dolittle or a Guess Who's Coming to Dinner does, because I think part of it is because they tapped into what was going on at the time. And it just seems like now the industry is not in a position, they're so disconnected from the zeitgeist of now, or they're wrapped in their own idea of what the zeitgeist is, that they're incapable of producing work like that. So what I'm excited about, and what I hope for, is that we have another sort of renaissance like the 70s, where we see these gritty, down to earth, but powerful films and stories that can be shared, you know, with technology and distributed around the world pretty quickly. So I think, you know, I'm not going to catastrophize, like filmmaking isn't going to die. Theater won't die, but I do think now it's going to be more decentralized, maybe more democratized, and more people will have access to these mediums. And like you've been saying this whole interview, I think it's great, you know, and I've had to learn myself as well, as that, you know, the learning how to sell, learning about marketing, learning about business, learning, you know, just basic things like copywriting, you know, like if you as an artist can get over your ick feeling when it comes to money, because I have the same thing. Trust me, yeah. I have the same thing. And if you can learn to expand your skills, because, you know, I keep meeting scientists who like are artists, but I rarely meet artists who are great scientists, you know, or scientific thinkers. It's like, guys, you know, now is the time. If you want to be in the, you know, at the head of the new, I'll use the term, cultural revolution, now is the time to level up, get your skills up, practice your art, but also, you know, the entrepreneurial skills that we've been talking about. And that, I think, is the wave of the future, is these independent artists with their teams putting out amazing stuff. And hopefully, and I've been preaching about this in the alternative space, that instead of, you know, trying to be podcasters, will actually make more and more culture. I mean, Drinker's got his movie coming out. You know, Razor Fist has a book coming out. I know that, you know, Eric July has a book coming out. People are doing stuff, and it's catching on slowly but surely. But my opinion is that, you know, if we're fighting a culture war, we have to make culture in order to win it. And now we're in a position where these old institutions are dying. And now there's an opportunity now for just extraordinary people from all over the world, all over the country, to really serve the public and the people in a way that the mainstream entertainment industry is just failing right now. Chris, how can people find and support you if they want to do so?
Real easy. On social media, my personal social media is @ChrisGore. And on Film Threat is just filmthreat.com. Film Threat on YouTube, Instagram, X. Just look up Film Threat. And that's how you can find me. I'm pretty easy to find.